Today in Studio 360, subtract line 47B from line 352. Add what you get in line 27A. Toss in the square root of line 342.6 and then enter that on line 692. Come on, really?
Why Kai Rizdahl of Marketplace hates the IRS Form 1040, but loves our new content to make something creative out of it. Plus, Dorothea Lange took one of the most famous photos ever made in America, that shot of the migrant mother and her children during the Depression. Photographers dream about making an iconic picture like that, but be careful what you wish for. The story of that photograph is later in the show, along with much more. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But to start, what I do here is about as easy and fun as a job in journalism gets. Actual day-to-day hard journalism is not glamorous in the least. It's making lots and lots of phone calls to strangers and people who don't want to talk to you or don't want to tell you the truth. It's reading and deciphering endless boring documents. It's working on stories that don't pan out, or when they do, usually nobody much pays attention, which makes the movie Spotlight all the more remarkable. It's about how the Boston Globe's investigative team 15 years ago uncovered staggeringly pervasive sexual abuse of children by Roman Catholic priests in Boston, and its cover-up by the church. And those stories, of course, prompted the rolling discovery that this was a pervasive, long-running horror show all over the world.
We need to focus on the institution, not the individual priests. Practice and policy. Show me the church manipulated the system so that these guys wouldn't have to face charges. Show me they put those same priests back into parishes time and time again. Show me this was systemic, that it came from the top down.
That's Liev Schreiber as Marty Baron, the Boston Globe editor at the time. Tom McCarthy wrote the screenplay and directed the film. It is up for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Original Screenplay and Best Director. And he is here with me now, Tom McCarthy. Congratulations. Your cup runneth over, as a priest might say.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
As I said before, I loved how you really showed the tedium of real journalism. But did you ever worry and stop and think, oh my gosh, I've got to maintain the entertainment value and the drama. I can't just keep showing the reporters looking through lists of priests' names.
Of course. I worried about it all the time. I mean, you're right. We completely committed to the craft of journalism in some ways, warts and all, and boring and tedium and all. And that was one of the gambles of this movie. We committed to process. We said, let's show all the little bits that add up to something truly extraordinary in terms of the result of this investigation. And I think early on, Josh and I, spending so much time with the reporters, felt in fact that we were conducting our own investigation into their investigation.
Yeah, Josh Singer, your co-writer.
Yeah, and we committed to that. And it certainly informed our writing every step of the way. And, you know, we were probably even guilty of geeking out a little bit on all the little details of the work that they do.
Yeah.
You know, I think when you see the film and you kind of get hooked on that, which audience seems to be doing, you appreciate that much more their work and their efforts.
Yeah. And you talked to them, people who had been victimized.
Yeah, specifically two of them that we sat with were Phil Saviano and Joe Crowley, both depicted in the film, and just extraordinary gentlemen who have really turned their lives around and become activists in the fact that this never happens again. Like they're really, you know, you only have to really sit with one survivor to understand the impact of this crime and how this is something that these men and women, in some cases, carry with them for the rest of their lives.
And so was that, this director's coming in, you sit down with him for an hour, good, nice talking to you. What was that? What were those experiences
like? No. I mean, I still email with both these gentlemen. So once you develop a relationship, much like the reporters, it continues. And their back and forth was incredibly informative in putting the screenplay together.
Really?
Putting the language.
So before you wrote the screenplay, it wasn't just, I want to meet this guy to see what he's like.
No,
now
no.
That we've
it was
him.
Sit down. It was interview, record it. Josh and I recorded every interview we sat. We did. We would sit back with those tapes and kind of review them for language. And then we would let them read scenes. We let Phil Saviano read some of the scenes and actually give us input on some of the language. I mean, this is a man that's been, you know, studying this now, and not just having survived it, but has been living and studying it for 25, 30 years. So his input was invaluable.
Another aspect of journalism that you get very right, it's not something the movie says, but is true in my experience over years being around journalism. Investigative journalists really are a different species, and they really are sometimes over-invested in what they're certain is true. The Mark Ruffalo character is like some of those guys I've known, which is to say they sometimes have a bit of a screw loose. Not that that real guy he plays did, but do you know what I mean?
I absolutely know what you mean. It's funny. As a filmmaker, I collaborate with a host of different artists, right? And I will say, one day it occurred to me that journalists in some way remind me of musicians. They just beat to their own drum. They do their own thing and they do it their way. And, you know, I'm not terribly musical, so I have to figure out a way to communicate with musicians, especially when I'm scoring a film, obviously. And I found the same way with journalists, especially investigative journalists. Yes. They're their own breed. And it's weird. They're incredibly dynamic people. They're very serious people. And they're also, you know, because they were the sort of subject of our investigation, they're sometimes very difficult to penetrate, to get to know. They do not like being in that seat. They like asking the questions. So,
and keeping their cards close to their vest.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I want to play a clip, which is a discussion, a heated discussion between Boston Globe reporter Mike Resendiz, played by Mark Ruffalo, and Michael Keaton's character, his boss, Robbie Robinson. They're discussing how to handle the documents that apparently demonstrate the church and cardinal law had covered up these years of sex abuse.
If we don't rush to print, somebody else is going to find these letters and butcher the story. Joe Quimby from the Herald was at the freaking courthouse.
Mike.
What? Why are we hesitating? Barron told us to get law. This is law.
Barron told us to get the system. We need the full scope. That's the only thing that will put an end to this.
Then let's take it up to Ben. Let him decide.
We'll take it to Ben when I say it's time.
It's time, Robbie. It's time. They knew, and they let it happen. Two kids. Okay? It could have been you. It could have been me. It could have been any of us. We gotta nail these scumbags. We gotta show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
That was Mark Ruffalo and Michael Keaton in Spotlight. Now, journalists seldom give that aria. Or if they do, they don't last long in their newsrooms. Did you worry like, oh, this is just too much, this is too dramatic in the melodramatic sense?
Well, I always worry about just about everything. As a director, it's part of my job description. I will say this. That is probably the one blow up in the movie. It happens about three quarters of the way in the movie, and it happens when the tension has built quite a bit. So it felt at that point like it was time for release. And it's not unlike Mike Resendiz to get very fiery and overstep, and he'll be the first to tell you that. And this also comes at a moment where they discovered these 14 documents that were virtually plucked from the Archdiocese file cabinets, which told them everything they needed to know.
Right.
When you read these letters from parishioners to the cardinal, it is absolutely beyond belief. It is heartbreaking. It is tragic. And this felt like the moment to express that, knowing that these guys, specifically Mike and Robbie, banged heads quite a bit. It's just part of the job. It's part of a very, I think, successful collaboration, to be quite honest. So in this moment, that's what we were focusing on as filmmakers. I will say, I think what's really important about this scene is what Robbie's saying. Yes, we could go with this. We could, but we're going to be patient. We're going to get the whole story. And I think that's what made this story so absolutely effective, ultimately, was that they had the patience not to rush this to press. And there's many instances along the way they could have. I think a lesser paper, lesser editor.
The Boston Herald, for
instance. Would have. The Herald absolutely would have. But I think, you know, that's an important element. And, you know, specifically now in this 24-hour news cycle, I mean, things are on, you know, something's reported all the time and then retracted.
Right.
All the time. What happens? It loses effectiveness.
Yeah.
And they were so patient, and this story was so effective as a result.
Right. It has pretty heroic heroes. We heard the Mark Ruffalo speech earlier. It has all this old-fashioned shoe leather reporting. It has no sex, I don't think. Mm. It has no car chases. It has no violence. It has no CGI. And justice triumphs. And cinematically, it's very linear and straightforward. Did you envision it as a kind of plain old-fashioned movie?
Yeah. Look, I think whenever I take on a film, the style in which I direct it, write and direct it, is representative of the film itself, of the content.
Yeah,
and here we're
yeah.
talking about journalism. It ain't flashy. It ain't sexy.
Right.
It gets to the point, and when it's done well, it's incredibly impactful, and that's what we were shooting for. Yeah. And I think to suddenly impose a style that felt too manipulated or too...
I'm watching a movie.
Yeah, you'd be aware you watch a movie. We wanted people to feel like they were observing this, yeah. like they were living it. It's 2001, you're there, what do you do?
Right.
And so we favored that style, and it's a very austere approach to the material, and hopefully people don't even realize it. hopefully they're just caught up in it.
You played a journalist on The Wire who made up stories, this loathsome yuppie. And you don't seem to be a loathsome yuppie. what was your understanding of that character as you played him for a season? You must have found ways to be sympathetic.
You know, I have to credit David Simon with that and his team because, you know, I was actually editing The Visitor when they cast me in that. And I didn't have a lot of time.
The great Richard Jenkins film.
Yes. Nominated for an Oscar. Wonderful actor. Actually, it appears in Spotlight. He plays the voice of Richard Sipe. I called on him and he plays that, you know, that the ex-priest who keeps calling in and giving Mike uh-huh. information on the phone. That's the great Richard Jenkins.
Huh.
But I was editing The Visitor and I was kind of – David called me and said, I have this role for you if you're interested. And I said, yeah, sure. And he didn't tell me much about it. He just said, I just think it's right for you. Later on, I discover it's the most weaselly character
yes.
in the history of the show.
Yes.
And maybe the most reviled.
Just as Mr. Quisling became a word, that guy could become the word for bad –
Yeah.
Weasley journalist.
Yeah, I was it. I mean, yeah. you know, for years after I would go to do press for any of my movies or walk through a newspaper and people would just be glaring at me. People really yeah. don't like me. But what a great show. And, you know, that just unfolded. And what David kept telling me along the way was, you're not a bad guy. You're just ambitious. You
right.
just want to get to the top. You
right.
want to make an impact.
Right.
And it's a wonderful way to play it. It's a very smart direction.
Your last movie before Spotlight was The Cobbler, which critics didn't much like. Yeah. I haven't seen, so I can't speak to that. And I don't think that many people beyond the critics saw it, probably. Was that a terrible, terrible experience?
No, not at all.
Really?
Yeah, no. It's the okay. first time I'm looking you directly in the eye. It's a fascinating experience. Is it hard? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always hard. It's hard to make a good movie. It was incredibly liberating in a way. I'd made three movies that were very critically, very well received.
Yes.
Station Agent,
Visitor, and did Wingo. Okay. I looked up there. Yeah, they probably all broke even.
By all accounts, very good.
Yes.
All good. And then I made The Cobbler, which is very different than those movies. And you're right. The critics went after it early on in a way that felt... felt a little bit like they're all on the bandwagon.
Well, a lot of pent-up anti-Adam Sandler feeling.
They really don't like Adam, which is evident and unfortunate because I don't know a nicer, more generous,
yeah.
hardworking actor than
yeah.
Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
And I would work with him again in a flash. That said, you know, it's a really interesting thing to go through. I was actually in pre-production for Spotlight when that was all playing out at the Toronto Film Festival, and I thought, well, if this is the worst of it, I just have to keep telling stories and take away what I can, but that's why I wouldn't categorize that as a bad experience, but a really fascinating, informative one.
Are you done acting?
I hope not. I hope not. I hope my agent's listening to this and she's feeling the heat.
Really? Why?
I love acting.
Sure.
I started doing that. It was my entree into all this. Look, if you told me, you know, when I was 20 that I'd be an actor for a profession, I would have laughed in your face. The fact that now I've not only had this acting career, but I'm able to make movies, I feel like the luckiest guy on the planet. It's a great, great job. There's something about acting that's just fun. And it provides me the opportunity to collaborate with other directors, other writers,
right.
not only to watch them work from the sidelines, but to be immersed in that work. And that's incredibly informative.
It must be easier, too.
You know, you're not burdened with as much when you're an actor,
yeah.
but it's a tricky job.
I'm not saying it's easy, but easier.
Yes. I know I'm going to hear from it now.
Well,
all my friends.
Obviously true.
My friends are going to be so angry with me. But yeah, it's probably easier.
Tom McCarthy, thank you very much.
It's been fun chatting. Real pleasure.
Spotlight is up for 6 Academy Awards. It is a date everybody knows, a date filled with meaning that comes around once a year, but not a holiday. Kind of the opposite of a holiday, in fact.
The taxman's taken all my dough.
April 15th, Tax Day. Not necessarily awful, but nobody's idea of fun. I actually don't so much mind paying the taxes, but filling out complicated forms of any kind and those schedules, just not my thing. So, listeners, let's reframe the whole April 15th ritual, okay? In other words, get creative, by which I don't mean taking bogus deductions. It's our new listener challenge. We want you to turn IRS Form 1040, the thing itself, into something interesting, surprising, beautiful, strange, ridiculous, subversive, cool. Make a work of art or craft out of Form 1040. You can print it out and paint or draw on the form or make origami or fill it out as, I don't know, Jay Gatsby. You could use it for paper mache or cross stitch on it. Anything goes. We're calling this contest Defile Your Taxes. And to judge your entries, Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace. Kai, welcome.
Thanks so much. So good to be here.
Thank you for agreeing to judge this contest.
You bet.
Last fall, you tweeted that you wish taxes could be completed on a form that fit on a postcard. Where did that idea come from?
Well, I think it actually came from Ted Cruz, and I was probably mostly making fun of him.
Uh-huh.
I would just as soon have the government just take whatever it wants out of my money and then leave me alone. So I don't, as you said, have to fill out the forms. I mean, it almost wrecked my marriage, those damn forms.
Yes. No, I wondered if Ted Cruz had stolen it from you or you from him, but I'm happy to know it was the reverse. Are there things about the form itself, about Form 1040, that frustrate you?
Well, so the short answer is yes. But just for instance, subtract line 47B from line 352. Add what you get in line 27A. Toss in the square root of line 342.6.
Right.
And then enter that on line 692.
Right.
Come on. Really?
Bad design.
It's terrible. And we should actually do that story, right? The industrial design of the 1040.
Yeah.
That would be a really good story.
Yeah. Graphic design,
well,
but yes.
Yeah. Well, okay. Graphic design, yes.
Yeah.
Honestly, here's the thing I don't quite understand. The government knows exactly how much money I make. They know my investments. They know, you know, whatever. I'm all on the record, right? I don't have tip income. And that whole thing is a different deal, mm-hmm. right? The cash economy.
Mm-hmm.
But for most people in most professions, I would dare say, the government knows what's going on. So why don't you just do your taxes for me and send me a bill?
Because
and I know people are going to go, oh, my God. But
no, you know, we're Americans and we want the illusion of freedom.
I know. That's a whole different topic.
So we are asking our listeners to do something creative with the
Form
1040. As the judge of this contest, are there things in particular that you might be looking for?
Well, so here's what would turn me on in terms of people and their submissions in this thing. And you mentioned one of them in the introduction, origami. I had a guy a couple of years ago, just because it's a piece of paper, right? I had a guy a couple of years ago send me two $2 bills. One was folded as a male Japanese warrior character and the other one as a female.
Huh.
So I think origami is really cool just in and of itself, and you can do interesting things with that. I really, really like photography. I'm a big photography guy.
Huh.
I enjoy pencil drawings and sort of charcoal-y stuff. You know, paints don't do it for me and composites don't do it for me and stuff like that. So,
although maybe if there's a painter out there, they can win you over.
Maybe they can. And let's take that as the challenge, right?
Yeah.
Let's take that as the challenge.
Well, I want to thank you in advance for doing this. And God knows how many we're going to.
Lots.
The
we'll
deluge
lots.
Of entries we're going to submit you to. But doing this and knowing you're going to be the judge makes me kind of look forward to tax
credits. Well, good. Me too.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
We'll talk again.
Yes, we will.
The deadline to submit your entry to Defile Your Taxes is midnight on April 3rd. You can do anything as long as you use the Real 1040 form. You can download the form and find out all the details of our challenge at studio360.org/defile.
$2,000 would save my life. $200 would ease the pain.
Coming up, a voyeuristic photographer on a stakeout.
And all of a sudden, a tap on my window. I jumped. There was a gentleman, and he said, Why are you photographing me in my house?
Busted. That is coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. You almost certainly don't know Florence Thompson's name, but you almost certainly do know the picture of her.
With my students, I have several times said, "What's your image of the Great Depression?" Stop right there, and they describe that picture.
Dorothea Lange was the photographer, and her picture was called Migrant Mother. As part of our ongoing series on American icons, we take a closer look at Migrant Mother. WNYC's Charlie Herman tells the story.
The first thing you should know about the making of the photograph is that it almost didn't happen. The second thing is that both women came to wish it hadn't. It was a rainy day, February 1936. Dorothea Lange was driving home to Berkeley, California. She'd been on the road for about a month taking photographs of migrant workers for the federal government. And just north of Santa Barbara in the town of Napomo, she saw a sign that read, Pea Pickers Camp. Lange was exhausted and she wanted to see her family, so she kept on driving. But she kept asking herself, what's the situation back there? So 20 miles down the road, she turned the car around and drove back to the camp. There she met Florence Thompson.
I saw and approached the hungry and desperate mother as if drawn by a magnet. I do not remember how I explained my presence or my camera to her.
These are Lange's words about the making of the photo.
I made 5 exposures, working closer and closer from the same direction. I did not ask her name or her history.
In Lange's picture, Thompson is looking off into the distance. Her right hand is raised to her lips, and 2 of her children are pressing against her. There's a baby in her arms.
And she seemed to know that my pictures might help her. And so she helped me.
Now, keep in mind, this photo was just one of thousands of pictures that Dorothea Lange took while working for the Farm Security Administration. Of all the pictures that were taken by the FSA, why do you think this one stood out the most?
I think because of the maternalism.
Linda Gordon is a history professor at New York University and the author of the biography, Dorothea Lange, A Life Beyond Limits.
I think that's the main source. There's just something about seeing a mother with kids that is going to evoke sympathy.
The thing is, before she started photographing destitute farm workers, Lange had been a portrait photographer in San Francisco for years, and a very successful one. She knew how to frame an image, and she knew what she was doing when she transformed Thompson and her kids into this vision of a Madonna and child.
She saw something about the expressiveness of the woman's face and body, but she also put together a composition that might have been in a Renaissance painting.
Once the photograph was published, people, especially newspaper editors, loved it. There was this hunger for images about the Depression.
Starts with the New York Times, July 5th, 1936, San Francisco News, March 11th.
It appeared next to any story about people in hard times, not just the pea pickers in California. And since Lange's photo belonged to the federal government, there wasn't, and still isn't, any copyright limiting who used it or how.
Well, there is a Black Panther leaflet that has the migrant mother with an afro on the front page. Here's one from the Watchtower announcing Jehovah's Kingdom. There's one I know with perfume. There's one I know with Coach bags. Here's one selling Samsonite luggage.
What's the connection between that photograph and selling something like the Samsonite?
She's become what you would call an empty signifier. She doesn't actually mean what she originally meant to people. And Lange was furious about that. And she said, once I got a divorce from that picture, that picture doesn't belong to me.
The migrant mother, Florence Thompson, she threatened to sue. After seeing her face yet again in a magazine in 1958, she wrote, "Should the picture appear in any magazine again, I and my 3 daughters shall be forced to protect our rights." But she had no rights. She later told a reporter she wished Lange had never taken her picture. Thompson was still scraping by, living in a mobile home in Modesto, when she died in 1983.
The migrant mother has been incinged and burned into my eyes and my mind since a child.
I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues.
LaToya Frazier is a photographer in her early 30s. When she was a teenager, looking at photo history books, she saw the migrant mother picture and asked herself,
well, who's that woman? And how did this image help her, you know, put her own voice out there into the world? Or how did it help her reveal what was happening in those moments for her and her family?
Frazier grew up in Braddock, Pennsylvania, a dying steel town. If migrant farm workers are the picture we have in our head of the Depression, it's places like Braddock that represent hard times now.
If I'm living in this industrial ruin that has been abandoned, and there's no one here from the media covering this, and no one telling our story about what we're dealing with, how do I pick up the camera and agency and start to document it and tell it for myself as a personal subject that did endure these things?
For more than 10 years now, she's been photographing herself, her mother, and her grandparents in Braddock.
This is the hospital being torn down on the right, and it's a diptych that has an image, which is actually my mother receiving an epilepsy test in the hospital. Some of these constant threads in my work dealing with the body and the landscape and the loss of healthcare and, you know, the way that the body also breaks down and the toxicity of the town. So this very formal way, a very formal poetic way of touching on that visually.
Her goal is not just to document. She wants viewers to know the people in her images like she does. She doesn't want what happened to Florence Thompson to happen to them.
What would Dorothea Lange's own self-portrait look like if she did it herself, of her and her children and her husband, instead of someone from outside that was commissioned by the government?
Today, anyone can document their community. It's not like in Dorothea Lange's time when cameras were for pros. We shoot with our phones, and thanks to apps like Instagram, we have plenty of ways to share our work. But making an image that endures? That's hard. When the economy crashed in 2008, I started seeing the migrant mother a lot. And that made me think, even after the billions of pictures online, we still couldn't come up with our own image of the times we're living through.
I think that great images will continue to bubble to the top, although it is interesting in this era of sort of image proliferation, it's harder and harder.
Sarah Meister is a photography curator at the Museum of Modern Art.
What's amazing about this photograph is that I don't think you need to be a mother to empathize with her. So certainly I look at her and I feel the moment that we're in the world. It's much easier to empathize and to sort of personalize what you think she's going through. At the same time, I don't think that's a necessary requirement for appreciating and feeling the power of this image.
In other words, Meister is saying it's not just about the economy. It's something about the human condition, even if you're not worried about where your next meal is coming from. What that something is, even Lange didn't have the answer. Speaking towards the end of her life in an interview with KQED, she still couldn't explain it.
I have made a few photographs in my life that have really taken hold. It embarrasses me. They're no longer my own. For some peculiar, strange reason that I don't understand, that I haven't the answer for. Why those? There's something in them that has reached people all over. People think I didn't make anything out.
You can see the migrant mother photograph and the others Lange took on that day exactly 80 years ago at studio360.org. Thanks to Charlie Herman of WNYC for that story. Florence Thompson regretted that Lange ever took her picture, but at least she knew it was being taken. The photographer Michelle Everson is not in the habit of asking permission. She takes photos of unsuspecting people in their homes from outside at night, a peeping Tom artist. And her methods sometimes do get her in trouble.
I remember one night, I drive up to this one house, and I had my camera on my seat, strapped in, focused on a particular window. and I was sitting in front of it, and I must have been there, you know, a while, maybe a half hour. I watched for a long time, and I was fixing my camera and checking everything. And all of a sudden, a tap on my window. I jumped. There was a gentleman, and he said, "Why are you photographing me in my house?" And so I did say to him in a loud voice, I said, "I'm a photographer, and I'm photographing people in their homes at night." And I just started my car and drove away. My name is Michelle Everson. I began this photographic series in 1995. The name of the series is Night Surveillance Series. And what I am doing is photographing people at night in their homes. And I use the camera to create these intimate type of discoveries. I'll look at one of the photographs and talk to you about it. Untitled number 88 is two people in the image, and it was the oddest thing. They were interacting, but his back was to her, and her face was to his back. They weren't talking, but they kept moving, and I was very curious as to what was going on. And finally, he had stepped back slightly into an area where I could see him, and she was popping his pimples. There was another image that I was looking in on a neighbor, and she was binging, eating potato chips. Potato chip after potato chip was going into her mouth. They're like these beautiful tableaus to me. They tell a story. They show people's lives. I kind of find my theater, you know, the actual window. And then the performance begins. This is what happens. All of a sudden, I get very excited. It's like, oh, my God, this is what they're doing. I've got to get this, you know. And then I shoot it, and I take off as fast as I can because I want to get out of there. I just want to leave because it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for me to be watching them. They're black and white images, approximately 40 by 48 inches in size. I need to have these images be approximate size of the windows and make you as uncomfortable as I am when you're looking at them because, you know, because you become complicit in looking at them. I watched her for a while. She was in her kitchen. I loved the shape of the shade. And she finally turned around and came straight for the front of the window. And then she picked up this plate. It was a small, like a dessert plate. It was almost in slow motion for me as she put it up to her face and began to lick the plate. And when I go home after I finish shooting, I'm like, shut the doors, shut the windows, close everything, you know, because I know who I am and I know what I'm doing, but I don't know who's out there watching me. And when I know that they're going to be seen in a gallery or on the internet or wherever they're going to be, I feel like this is an exposure that excites me, you know? I think about it all the time, like, what if the shoe were on the other foot? If someone else were doing this to me, would I be mad? Yes. Would I feel upset? Probably. Was it my own fault? Yes. Did I have my window open? Yes. That's how I look at it. And I don't know exactly when I'm going to put it to rest. It could be tomorrow. but I've been watching someone's house lately that I think I really do want to make a photograph of.
You can see some of Michelle Everson's night surveillance series at studio360.org. While you're there, let us know what you think of her MO. Are her photos fascinating or creepy or very, very creepy? Jonathan Mitchell produced our story. Still ahead, she was the most photographed woman of the 19th century, but that wasn't the most interesting thing about her.
She was sent with the mission of seducing Napoleon III. She was, in all likelihood, a spymaster.
The novelist Alexander Chi is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. Like stories about ideas and culture and the arts, books. So where do you go after Studio 360 is over? There's another podcast from PRI called To the Best of Our Knowledge. It's a series of weekly conversations with writers and scholars and activists and artists about the ideas that are shaping the world. To the Best of Our Knowledge is really a perfect companion for people with curious minds. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Alexander Chi's new novel is a romance about an American girl in 19th century Paris, and it is written like a novel from that era. It's a highly operatic tale about opera. The heroine bounces from one identity to the next, a frontier orphan who runs off to join the circus, then a prostitute in Paris, then a royal chambermaid, a spy, finally an opera superstar. The novel's called The Queen of the Night, and it is a page-turner whose beautiful prose makes the pages worth turning. Chi's first novel was highly autobiographical and contemporary. I asked him why he chose to write his second one about a fabulous opera diva in 1860s and 70s Paris.
I wanted to bring alive that kind of excitement that people had back then for the opera. And, you know, I think now it's thought of as something that's a little fussy.
Yes, and stuffy, then, and for rich people only, and all that.
Exactly, and back then it was so damn sexy.
Yeah. Your voice, your woman, your genius, your strange woman, Lillie Byrne, she is loosely based on a real 19th century singer, Jenny Lind. How loosely, and where did Jenny Lind come into your thinking as you were thinking about your character?
It's a pretty loose association. So sometime in 1999, I ran into my friend, the late David Rakoff, on the street. And for some reason, he told me a story about how Jenny Lind had quit the stage early in her career.
At the peak of her superstardom.
At the peak of her superstardom. And then P.T. Barnum had approached her about a farewell tour, and she agreed. She insisted on a $500,000 advance, and he came up with it. And then she went on a two-year farewell tour, and David just found this remarkably hilarious. He called her a 19th century Cher, a goodbye that would not end. And I thought that there was a circus.
Right. Your main character starts off as a circus performer, but P.T. Barnum wasn't involved with circuses until way after Jenny Lind.
Exactly. That was my naive mistake. And so
When
I discovered that wasn't true, I still had this image in my head of this opera singer in a train with a circus, you know, sneaking out to hang out with the elephants at night. And then I thought, oh, that's the novel.
There are, not Jenny Lind, but a bunch of real people who are characters in the novel, like George Sand and Verdi. One of the supporting characters, who is based on a real person, fascinating real person whom I knew nothing about, is the Countess of Castiglione. Talk about her.
She was novelistic goldmine to me.
Really?
I mean, she was sent by the Italian embassy at the age of 19, shortly after her marriage, to Paris with the mission of seducing Napoleon III and, as a result, winning his support for Italian unification. And she was an incredible beauty. She was, in all likelihood, a spymaster. And I kept finding details in the Met catalog for this photographic show of her portraits that suggested a lot of the plot that's in the novel.
She was photographed a great deal.
Yes. She might be the most photographed woman of the 19th
century. Yeah, in costume and in all kinds of... I mean, she's just... She's an amazing figure. I would have been tempted to make the whole novel about her, practically.
And yet, I think the Comtesse is so beautifully mysterious and enigmatic that in a way...
Right.
I didn't know how to inhabit her that way to,
right.
like, to write first person from her voice.
Better to keep her in the shadows.
I suppose I thought that was the way.
I want our listeners to hear some from the book. In this section, the main character is a famous opera singer in Paris. Her voice is amazing, and people are suspicious of where her voice came from, and she's addressing the myths.
There's a story told of my voice that says it was bought from a witch, the result of an occult surgery. I'm said to treat it nightly with arcane oils and ointments, my real voice in a box on the witch's mantle. If you lift the lid, apparently, you can hear it saying everything I can't say with this voice, the voice that sings. The witch's bargain is that I cannot perform normal speech. I never corrected this. I like to imagine myself returning to the witch to bargain again. Pulling aside my scarf, a door there cut along my throat, opening like a clock. I raise the box to my throat, and out comes something small and fierce. It hops in my hand like a little bird. What would it say? The real answer to where my voice came from is as ordinary as all of life. In Paris, in the winter, the chestnut trees in the bois drop their nuts, and the poorest gather them and roast them in fires on the street corners. The smell of them to me is the smell of the Paris winter coming. Wrapped in old newspapers, the corners folded back, the chestnuts steam in a neat pile, their split backs curling open. I wanted to eat, and so I learned to sing. I the same as the woman who on a winter afternoon roasts chestnuts from the Bois de Boulogne and sells them so she can buy her dinner. It took more than a witch to make a singer out of me. And if it was a gift from God that made me this way, it was the gift he gave us all, called hunger.
Have you spent a lot of time in Paris?
I have now.
Since writing or while figuring out how to write this?
Well, figuring out how to write this, yeah. I went on several trips. I think the most exciting was probably the one where I discovered at the last minute there was a show of the Empress's clothes at the Museum of Fashion.
The Empress, who is also in your book.
Yes.
That one.
And the Empress Eugenie. And it was as if someone knew that I was writing about the Empress and her clothes, and they had just decided to unpack everything that still existed and let me see it.
How convenient.
Yeah.
There's a lot of description of women's clothes and men's, but especially women's clothes in this book. Is that a thing you were into and knew about before?
My fascination with women's clothes began very early. I think probably age 7.
Uh-huh.
I started paying attention to my mother's clothes. My mother was very, she was a very fashionable woman. She also made her own clothes. She was a home ec teacher.
Huh.
And she had these fashion magazines that she would get, and I would draw the women in them. And pretty soon by, I think, middle school, my art teacher suggested that I have a fashion drawing show. I remember my mother seeing it, and she said to me something to the effect of, "Now you should try to make something you can sell at the church sale." which I thought was the most bewildering kind of artistic direction, but I understood.
She was keeping it real.
She was keeping it real. And I started telling people I wanted to be a fashion designer. So it started very early.
Yeah. Why didn't you become a fashion designer? You did this better?
That's a good question. I mean, you wouldn't probably know it to look at the way I dress, but I still think a lot about fashion. And I think it's awesome.
I'm glad I don't know it from looking at the way you dress, which is as schlubby as I dress. So good. And I should explain to people that we are both wearing navy blue cardigans. So I guess this starts the navy blue cardigan rule from now on. Everybody dresses. Have you been an opera fan, or is this a new thing?
Not a new thing. As a kid, I was in a boys' choir, a professional boys' choir. And being a boy soprano, you're aware that your voice has an expiration date.
Yes.
And for me, my singing voice had really kind of rescued me from the sort of scene that I was in at school, where I was this kind of unpopular, bookish kid who had an indeterminate ethnic background and yet was still called a chink all the time.
Because one of your parents was Korean?
Yeah, my father. You know, and if you tell a racist, you know, I'm not Chinese, I'm Korean.
Yeah, that isn't going to do it.
So, you know, I became fascinated with women sopranos because they had a future that I didn't as a singer.
Right, right.
And so it was a kind of envy for the impossible in a sense. And it was in keeping with, I suppose, my fascination with women's clothes, which was about the power of feminine allure, you know.
Right.
Especially as a kind of proto-gay kid, you know, the idea of being desirable to men, having the power to command the desire of men, that was fascinating to me.
Right.
And so all these fascinations, I guess you could say, built up over time into this book.
Right. As a kid, you bounced around a lot. South Korea, Guam, Maine. Does that peripateticness and having presumably to invent yourself a little bit again and again, does that inform this character, Lillier?
Very much. I think one of the few things that I gave to her, I suppose, out of my own existence was that feeling that there was a home somewhere ahead of you that you had not yet found, where you would feel that you belonged more than the place you were from. That, and also being something that your parents couldn't really imagine. You know, I think when you're biracial, the way I was at the time that I was in Maine, people kept asking me, like, what are you? What are you? What are you? And it was like I wasn't even human. You know, I came from two very old families that had long traditions. My mother's family has been in Maine for over 350 years on the same farm. My father's family came to Korea in the 15th century from China. You know, these are traditions that I grew up with. So
right.
I had a very strong sense of identity
right.
in one sense.
Right.
But my public identity...
That's really interesting, especially given the extreme rootedness on both sides.
Yeah.
Alexander, it has been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Me too.
Alexander Chee's novel, The Queen of the Night, is out now. Thanks to Lorraine Maddox for reading the excerpt from the book. And that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. By the way, it is never too early to defile your taxes. Find out all you need to know at studio360.org/defile. And don't forget to play Oscars Bingo with us on Sunday. We'll be tweeting along with every slip and gaffe and yawn we see. And you can get your bingo card on your tablet or phone at studio360.org/bingo. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. The team here includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frassica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Karen Shikoji,
Tommy Bazarian,
Danielle Fox,
Afi Yellowdew,
Kate Essig.
And special thanks this week to John Asante. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360 is supported by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
WRFI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the singer-songwriter Shilpa Ray combines her love of punk and her classical Indian training on the harmonium to create a sound entirely her own. Shilpa Ray performs live next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.